This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. Merry Christmas. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin is off this week, and hopefully you are too, but we thank you for joining us today. We're going to start this hour with a check-in on Houston, one of the many places that was hit hard this year by the weather. Hurricane Harvey, which hit in late August, caused nearly $200 billion in damage, and recovery efforts are ongoing. We spoke with Houston resident Alma Roberts after Hurricane Harvey forced her and her family to evacuate their home, and we wanted to check in and see how they're doing.
Oh, yeah, it's been a couple months. It's been a journey. I guess I'm getting a little bit excited. I'd actually been kind of depressed the last couple months, but my husband's been really excited. And finally, I guess I'm starting to see a little bit more positivity in the horizon. We're going to rebuild. We're expecting the house to be torn down maybe before the end of the year. Everything just seems to be, you know, tomorrow and delays. But, you know, the house is being torn down fairly soon, and we're working with an architect to draft a sketch of a new home.
And where have you been living?
We've been renting. It's a small Airbnb, little townhouse.
And what about financially? How are things going for you in that sense? I mean, it's not cheap to rent an Airbnb for that long.
You know what? It's not. I was actually looking for a less expensive alternative. I was, you know, friends of friends have been helping me, realtors, to try to find an apartment, but it's five of us. And, you know, my husband was mentioning, even if we found a place that was less expensive, we don't have trash cans, you know, we don't have anything. And this place did come with, you know, a bunch of fresh, clean towels, just blankets, sheets, you know, things that I take for granted. So for us to go and spend more time right now, it just didn't make sense, especially when we're trying to really count our pennies, not a rebuild. So.
And what's the process been like in terms of getting insurance to pay for things?
Yeah, we did have flood insurance, but we don't qualify for like housing because it's a flood. There is no housing or food allowances or any. I mean, so the rent is on us. I'm thinking we're going to spend $24,000 is what I estimated in rent between, you know, the time now and 6 to 9 months, which is a fairly short time for a build. We met the builder prior to the flood over a year ago because we'd flooded before. So we, you know, had considered this before. Just we didn't think we had the money then. We probably don't have it now, but, you know, we're getting into new debt, and it's expensive, but we have to do what we have to do.
Yeah, it's not easy, but I understand that some of your neighbors have been dealing with situations that are even worse.
You know what, I think that's the part, you know, I've read a lot about being resilient, and I know, you know, just I'm a strong person, but this was a huge, huge blow. I've been really kind of depressed about the whole thing, and just getting into more debt just really stresses me out. But then I know, you know, just like you said, there's so many people going through worse. My neighbors had applied for an elevation loan or grant, sorry, prior to us even flooding, because this was our third flood. And I mean, it's a very slow process. So, you know, they're going to have to figure out, you know, how much insurance can take them and probably borrow to make the house right and elevate, you know, so that we are somewhat protected from another flood.
When you say this was your third flood, this was your third flood. Your house has been flooded three times.
This was the worst, but yeah, it's the third time water is in my house, correct.
How have your kids adjusted to all this change?
Jeremy, don't go there. I mean, it's they're good kids. Kids are awesome. I've got an 11, a 13. And the one that breaks my heart is I've got a 22-year-old. He just came out of the Navy. So, you know, he's been looking at being home after 4 years, and he's got no house. So,
yeah,
it's rough.
You say don't go there just because it's difficult to think about.
It's, yeah. But, I mean, I think they're okay. It just, it's tough. Right now, you know, the kids don't have, the Wi-Fi sucks. I'm just putting it out there. And, you know, they have homework, and we're all kind of fighting over a laptop because I lost two laptops with a flood. And, you know, the timing couldn't be worse for us to be buying new laptops right now.
Yeah. Do the holidays make it better or worse? Just because of all the stress of that, but at the same time, sometimes it makes people feel a little better.
It's a roller coaster. Like some days I'm really, really good. I was doing good prior to talking to you. I mean, I think the holidays are great. I've got a little Charlie Brown tree, and you know, I'm just grateful to have my family. The place is cozy, so I continue to focus on the positive things that, you know, it's bringing us closer. I am concerned. I think, you know, we're going to have a new normal. Like, you know, some days I think it's never going to be the same house. It's going to be a new house. And that's kind of exciting. But I'm concerned about what's the city doing. You know, what's going to happen the next time we have really bad weather, and if it rains a lot, you know, is the city, is the neighborhood prepared? We're not leaving the neighborhood. I'm kind of proud of that. We love our neighbors. So I am concerned about the infrastructure overall.
How come you're not moving out of the neighborhood?
We considered it, but it is our lot. You know, we had a lot of equity in the house, which was fortunate for us. We'd been there 15 years. So I think financially that was probably the best thing for us, to rebuild a house, you know, that was adequate enough to fit us. Living anywhere in Houston is pretty expensive. And then I think the schools, we didn't want them to have to go to different schools, school districts, and having so much change.
It's Alma Roberts, who lives in Houston with her family. They're still in the recovery process months after Hurricane Harvey destroyed their home. Alma, we're thinking of you. Thank you so much for speaking with us. And we look forward to hopefully getting a good update when we check back in with you again.
No worries, you guys. Take care.
In Broward County, Florida, just north of Miami, there is only one verified supercentenarian, someone over 110 years old. Her name is Maisie Ford. She is 111 and a half, and she spends a lot of her time making beanies for babies. WLRN's Katie Switalski paid her a visit.
When I first walked through the door to Maisie Ford's beach condo, she's wearing a blonde wig, some blue eyeshadow, and a pink blouse with a butterfly brooch. She tells me I'll never catch her without her pink lipstick on.
Grandchildren, 4. Great-grandchildren, I have 5. They call me Nana.
Maisie Ford is the oldest verified living person in Broward County and the second oldest in all of Florida. That places her as the 12th oldest supercentenarian in the country. She had the energy to sit and talk with me for nearly 3 hours straight on a bright and clear Saturday afternoon.
Do you watch Dancing with the Stars? Does he look familiar? Here he is.
She jumps up and grabs her walker to move quickly across the room. She shows me a picture of Derek Hough with his arm around her on her 109th birthday. Like many South Floridians, Maisie started coming to Broward County as a snowbird. Each winter, she and her first husband, Harry, would leave Philadelphia for South Florida's beaches. Maisie's daughter, Joanne Levinson, called her one day in 1967. She asked her mom to spend the winter at what was then a new development called the Hemispheres. Joanne remembers Maisie passing the phone to her dad.
She said he wouldn't say no to me, and that's how they got their first apartment in this building.
Maisie still lives here in the same condo, independently, though a nurse helps her now. Independence has always been important to her. She got married in the early 1920s, shortly after women got the right to vote. She was 16.
Oh, when my husband asked me to marry him, I said, only if you buy me a car.
By the time Maisie had moved to Florida for good, she was a widow who had just remarried.
I played a lot of golf. I played a lot of bridge. And I had my own car.
Though she can't play golf anymore, she still loves her bridge and her mahjong. And her daughter Joanne comes over almost every day. The good genes run in the family. Joanne just turned 90.
She was always a sharp lady, an excellent bridge player, a terrific mahjong player.
And really artistic. For her 100th birthday, as a party favor for her guests, Maisie made small wire butterflies with hundreds of tiny pink beads by hand.
Mother made for each place card at her dinner. She's been a butterfly lady.
When she got bored with beading, Maisie moved on to knitting. She started with blanket squares for the nonprofit Warm Up America. Now she's been knitting and delivering hats for newborn babies at Memorial Regional Hospital in Hollywood, Florida, every month. It's the only time she leaves her condo. The hats are how Maisie met Marla Oxenhandler. Marla used to work at the hospital.
She used to just bring them and drop them off at security, and it didn't make her feel that good because she didn't see where they were going.
So Marla started taking Maisie to visit the families who received her hats. Maisie holds up a pink, yellow, and green hat with a big yellow pom-pom on top. It's filled with tissue paper to keep its form.
I try to invent combinations. I think this is pretty. I enjoy every bit of what I'm doing.
Joanne helps knit the hats. Not as many as her mom, though.
It keeps her interested. It keeps her mind active. It gets her out with people, so she's not just confined to the apartment all the time. These things have kept her going. I hope it keeps me going.
90-year-old Joanne and her 111-year-old mother used to knit at least 50 hats a month. But they've slowed down a little.
Because I can't work as fast and she doesn't work as fast.
Can you imagine she doesn't work as fast at 111 and a half?
Maisie Ford is already planning ahead for her 112th birthday on June 28th, 2018. She hopes to have a quiet dinner at her favorite restaurant on the first floor of her condo with Joanne and Marla. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Spitalski.
Good for her. And by the way, we're keeping an eye on the weather on this Christmas Day. There were blizzard conditions in parts of New England, heavy lake effect snow in the Great Lakes, Steamboat Springs, Colorado, digging out from 15 inches of snow. Not a white Christmas in Death Valley. Sunny today with a high of 73. Key West, Florida, even warmer, a high of 78. On this Christmas Day, when everybody is hopefully having some good food, we want to listen back to one of our favorite visits to one of the best restaurants in the world, Puyol, in the swanky Mexico City neighborhood of Polanco. We stopped by just before lunch when we broadcast from Mexico in April and found one of the head chefs, Coco Baker, busy at work in the kitchen. What is this that you're slicing?
This is white onion. There's some garnishes for the dishes, some sauces that we make in a minute.
It's different than the way that we would slice onions for other things. They're very, very thinly sliced.
Yeah, we call it juliana in Spanish.
Julienne would
julienne,
be the word.
Yeah, it would be in English. Yeah, it's really thin.
Yeah, we probably have about 15 or 20 people back here right now things up. 15?
15 for service.
How long does it take to do all of the prep necessary each day?
It's like 10 hours of prep.
10 hours.
Yeah.
Wow. And what's the hardest thing to do?
The hardest thing to do, the mole. We make the dough, the masa for the tortillas also every day. We also make the chocolate, el chocolate de la casa, and that's it. I think it's the hardest thing to do.
The man behind all this work is Chef Enrique Olvera, who's been called one of the best chefs in the world. I sat down with him at a table in the open-air dining room. Well, Chef Enrique Olvera, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure. Welcome to Puyol.
Say that again, because I would think if I just looked at it on a piece of paper that you would say it Pujol.
Yeah.
But it's not. Why?
It does have like a Catalonian influence, the name. I was born and raised in Mexico, but my grandfather, Enrique, had some Catalonian blood in him, and he was always very supportive of me being a cook. So I wanted to have him present in some form or fashion at the restaurant.
So the restaurant is called?
Puyol.
Puyol.
Yes.
Okay. And you started it when you were 24 years old.
Yeah, crazy, you know, that time flies in restaurants. And it's been quite a while. It's been a beautiful journey. I think the essence of the restaurant is still here, which is to have a beautiful experience dining out. Obviously, with time, we've gotten much better at doing so. In the beginning, the restaurant was much more basic. There wasn't a clear style of cooking. But I think now we've accomplished something that is very special, especially in this new spot.
What was the concept at the beginning?
The concept in the beginning was to have a small neighborhood restaurant. We wanted to do contemporary cooking. I went to school at the CIA, and I saw how the New American Cuisine movement started to become very important in the U.S., and I always thought that Mexico had a very rich cultural heritage and a beautiful gastronomic scene, and therefore we could also make new cuisine from Mexico. So we started incorporating some ingredients.
What kind of ingredients do you incorporate?
Things that we found in the market, you know, cilantro, pineapple. The first menu was French and classical, but with Mexican ingredients. So we're doing like seared foie gras with mango. That was also a dish that Jean-Georges von Richten at some point did. You could see the influence from the market. You can see the influence from my training. And then as time went by and we started to become more comfortable, we started incorporating Mexican recipes into the mix. For example, the first dish that we had that was very Mexican was the robalo al pastor. It was a contemporary version of a street food, And we saw that people really enjoy that kind of food, so we started further exploring in that road using references from the streets instead of references from traditional Mexican cookery or the celebratory dishes of Mexican cooking, and we focused more on street food.
So would you say that this is new Mexican with an American influence or new American with a Mexican influence?
I think right now we've passed through many stages. I think that's one of the beautiful things about Puyol is that it's ever-changing. Right now, I would say it's a Mexican restaurant with a contemporary mindset, whereas before it was more of a contemporary restaurant with Mexican ingredients.
How did you get to the point where now people are saying, this is the best restaurant in Mexico?
I don't know. You have to ask people. I guess the word the best is difficult to assess. I think quality-wise, we do our best. We buy the best product that we can from the best producers. We have really serious and committed cooks and waitstaff. I would venture into saying we have the best cooks that I can say. I do not believe in that cooking is a competition. And therefore, saying best, it means that you're better than somebody else. And I think we're getting a better version of ourselves. So to me, food is more about where you're at. Puyol is a really old restaurant for Mexico City standards. So there's not a lot of restaurants that have been open for 17 years.
Why do you think that is?
It's a hard city. The dining scene here was very mellow. Until recently, there was not a lot of tourism in Mexico City. Until recent years, the tourism that came to Mexico City not necessarily came for food. There was more of a cultural scene going on. There was not a lot of Mexican restaurants either a few years ago. There's a lot of fondas, markets, street carts. But if you think of like a really strong Mexican fine dining institution, it's pretty recent that we started going into that world and also incorporating contemporary techniques and having a restaurant that was not traditional. I've never felt like I'm a traditionalist in the food world.
But you're still holding on to some traditions at the base of your cooking.
Yes, we're in love with our cuisine. But we believe that the best is in the future. In that way, we're very American, no? And a lot of Mexicans think the best is in the past. This city has been going on for thousands of years, and to me, yes, that is important if it makes you a better city now.
Let's talk about this space. This is a new space that you're in, and the atmosphere is very important to you as a chef and restaurant owner.
Yes, I believe that food is a big aspect of restaurants, but it's definitely not the only one and not the one that you go out for when you're going to a restaurant like this. I think that when you're coming to a restaurant like Puyol, you do expect that everything is well groomed, everything is well curated, that the experience is not only of a delicious taco, but a delicious taco in a beautiful piece of ceramic, no, with beautiful music in the background by a waiter that can have a conversation with you if you want to and not if you do not want to, in a space that reflects quality.
But you even had the music for the restaurant streaming on your phone. Do you DJ this restaurant?
I do go and DJ in almost every restaurant that I own.
Wow. Now, I'm looking at your menu for today, and the one thing that is actually not printed on the menu but written on the menu is how old the mole is, 1,261 days.
Yes.
Tell us about your mole.
Mole is it's an institution in Mexican cuisine, so it was really hard for us to start touching it. We didn't feel comfortable until recently on how to make a mole that was ours, and it was a version that would be in the same stature of the traditional one. There's a saying that mole recalentado is always better. Kind of like the turkey that you do the next day in Thanksgiving, No, it's always
it's better in leftovers.
Yeah, right? Right. It's kind of the same saying in Mexico. And so we decided just to start reheating the mole. Obviously, as you reheat it, the flavors mix a lot better. We obviously started running out of mole, so we had to make new mole, and we added it to the old mole. So we started like a solera system or a mother dough system. And then that's how the mole madre came about. But what we like is the idea of reheating and also leaving the mole by itself. Because if you go to a wedding in Mexico, nobody will say, like, the chicken was fabulous. You always talk about the mole.
What do you think about Mexican food in the United States?
I think that it's very close to we're neighbors, so there's a huge influence, especially in the southern states of the U.S. And there's many kinds of Mexican cuisine in the United States. What people understand as Mexican cuisine in California is completely different from what they understand in Texas.
Right.
And also, I think tacos are becoming universal. No, tacos are becoming like pizza. No, pizza is probably not Italian anymore. There's more pizza eaten in Brooklyn than in Italy, I bet. So in that sense, I think tacos will become also universal.
Have you ever been to a Taco Bell or a Chipotle?
I was once in a Taco Bell when I was in school at the CIA. It was a shopping mall, and there was like a little food court, and there was Taco Bell, and I tried it once, and
I didn't never like it. Again.
No. In general, I don't like the concept of fast food, but that was just, I didn't like it.
Well, Chef Enrique Olvera, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
And you can see photos from our April visit to Puyol in Mexico City at hereandnow.org. You might be looking at a beautifully decorated tree today, but in the next few days and weeks when the needles start dropping, what will you do with it? Well, there are more options than you might think. Joining us is Tim O'Connor from the National Christmas Tree Association. Welcome, Tim, and Merry Christmas.
Well, Jeremy, thank you, and Merry Christmas to you.
And what is the most common way that people dispose of their Christmas trees?
Well, the most common way is a community recycling center where the trees are chipped into mulch, and the mulch is either offered to the public or used on walking paths and playground areas and landscaping in the park districts of the community.
And is that what would happen if you just take your tree and put it out on the sidewalk after Christmas?
Generally, yes. Where I live, they have multiple locations where you can drop your tree off, and then they mulch it, and there's a big pile of mulch available to everyone to use. And yet, every community does something slightly different.
And is that a good use of an old Christmas tree?
I think it's one of the best. I mean, first of all, a Christmas tree is biodegradable. So over time, the mulch will go back into the soil as organic matter. But while it's still functioning mulch, it's providing a second use as a walking path or cushioning under playground equipment or filler underneath trees and bushes to keep the weeds from growing. So I think that's an excellent use. But there are a number of other things. They're used at zoos to give animals something to play with. They're used in fish habitat to give fish places to hide in so that predators don't come after them and lay their eggs.
Well, explain that one to me. Do they just put the tree, the whole tree, into the water for the fish?
Yes. And what they typically do, if it's cold winter location, is take it out on the ice. And then when the ice thaws, they submerge, and then the fish hide among the branches of the tree. Mm. I saw an article recently where a community along the shore uses them to help build new sand dunes. They anchor the trees down in locations where they'd like to create a new dune, and then as the wind moves the sand, the tree catches it, and before long, you can't see the tree anymore, and they have a new sand dune. And then they'll come out and plant grass on it to turn it into that grassy, beachy dune area that you often see.
But a lot of these are great ideas for people to do with their old Christmas trees. I have to say, though, that I assume a lot of Christmas trees just end up in a landfill somewhere.
You know, it's possible. I couldn't speak to that in terms of what each community does. But if they did, they're fully biodegradable. I mean, they are a plant.
Right.
And so they would biodegrade, whereas an artificial tree that's made from PVC plastic and steel is going to be there for 1,000 years and not biodegrade.
What do you do with your tree?
It goes to the community mulching, and it's part of our, you know, our family's ritual. We love everything about the tree, the getting the tree and decorating the tree. But even at the end, it's kind of melancholy that it's Christmas is over and you're taking your tree down. But it's always fun. The kids really enjoy to go take the tree, say goodbye. You know, we put it on the pile with hundreds of other trees. It's a very big pile. We know it's going to end up at the park. Kids always think that's just part of the whole experience, and they really enjoy it.
That's Tim O'Connor with the National Christmas Tree Association. Tim, thank you.
Jeremy, thank you.
And now that the tax cuts have been signed into law, it's not a bad idea to start thinking about your personal finances for 2018. Joining us with her thoughts is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill, and Merry Christmas.
And to you as well.
So let's start with taxes, because that is on everybody's mind right now after the passage of the big Republican tax cut bill. How does that affect how we should financially plan for next year?
You know, I think it makes it really hard. Normally, I put my certified financial planner hat on and I tell people to do the things that we always tell them to do. But this year, it's going to be so difficult to gauge. I think before the end of the year, you don't have to really do a ton of stuff. If for some reason you think you're an itemizer this year and you're going to claim the standard deduction next year, maybe you would accelerate paying property taxes or give a charitable contribution this year rather than next year. But for most of us, you don't have to do that much. Honestly, the best thing you can think about is, how does this impact your cash flow, and how should that change or not change what your long-term game plan looks like?
Well, if you do have a little extra cash coming in, what should you do with that?
Oh, my favorite thing to do is when Uncle Sam gives you a gift, please get it to work as fast as you can. Even if it's not that much, it's $100 a month, $200 a month, crank up your retirement plan contribution by that amount, or even a little bit less than that. I'll split it with you. You can spend half and save half, but get it going automatically. If you do that, you really won't miss it. You never had this money to begin with. So if you just took that money and said, oh, I'm going to bump up my 401k or my 403b or my Roth IRA contribution, especially if it's not a huge amount, that's when we tend to just sort of lose track of it. So get it to work.
Okay, get it to work. But what if you want to take some money off of the sidelines and put it into the market? Have you missed your opportunity because it's gone up by so much?
I face this question all the time. I think you've got to be honest with yourself. Did you sit out because you were really freaked out during the downturn and therefore maybe you shouldn't be a big time investor and maybe you just have to take it easy and take rotten returns for a while? If, however, you feel like, hey, I finally have some money and I can invest, you want to go slowly, and you're not going to try to pick the top or the bottom of the market. Don't wait for something to happen. Chances are, it's the day after you invest, if you're a first-time investor, the market will go down. I can almost guarantee that. But what you really need to think about is, what is my long-term game plan here? And don't get spooked. I mean, look, people who invested in the stock market maybe in October of 2007, they had to live through the whole horrible downturn in the financial crisis. But if they stuck to their game plan and they didn't take on too much risk, chances are they're ahead of the game right now. So that's a pretty good sign that if you stick with your game plan for the long term, you should be okay.
Do you think that 2018 is going to be a year in which we go into recession?
I'm the worst person to predict that. I generally think that the longer this whole expansion goes on, obviously the higher the risk is for a recession. But that said, the big picture of the world is that we're seeing growth. And it's not just in the U.S. It's this sort of synchronistic growth that's occurring in lots of different places. So with that backdrop and with interest rates still pretty low and this tax cut, which it may not long-term add to a ton of growth to the U.S. economy, but certainly in the short run it should. It's hard to see how that happens, and I'm going to put a little asterisk on that. If growth starts to crank up a little bit more than expected, we could see the Federal Reserve maybe start to raise rates faster than we anticipate. And could that snuff out not only a stock market rally, but the recovery? Absolutely. So things can happen all the time. You don't invest or not invest based on whether you think there is going to be a recession, because chances are you're investing for the next 20, 30 or 40 years.
If you decide at the beginning of the year to reevaluate your investments, how do you do that? What should you be looking at?
Well, I think the first thing that you look at the end of the year is you say, how'd I do? But you really want to be careful to compare your performance against the relevant benchmark. So if you are a young growth investor, yes, you can look at the U.S. stock market as a sort of a guidepost. But if you are someone who is very risk averse and you basically own stocks and bonds in equal proportion, then don't go complaining to your spouse like, hey, honey, you were a rotten investment advisor or your broker or your advisor and say, you know, you only gave me a portion of the upside of the market because you are not investing only in the market. It's also important if you did like a lot better than the market for some reason, I would also look at that and say, am I taking on a lot more risk than I realized?
I am looking right now at a retirement account that I have, and it is up 26% this year. I don't know if I'll ever see that again for the rest of my life, right? But it's tied to the market, and the market's done very well.
And the market's done well. And you know what? Let me just say this out loud in front of our entire audience. You are a genius, Jeremy.
Yes. I picked one of the three options, and I guess I did right.
You did incredibly well. You know, the other part of looking at what's going on in your portfolio is to look at what is the cost of your investing. We still have so many people who are invested in these managed mutual funds that have much higher fees than they need to have. I know not for every single asset class, but for the vast majority of us, like, why are you paying somebody that extra 1% to quote unquote manage your funds when you could keep that money yourself and just pick an index fund?
So when does it make sense to actually have a financial advisor then?
I think that a lot of people are going to find that they want an advisor or a CPA because their tax lives may have just gotten quite a bit more complicated because of this law. If you work right now with a broker or an investment person, the new year is a great time to go into your plain old, you know, annual meeting and you say, you know, can you remind me again, how exactly do I pay you? I mean, I'm always shocked at how much people don't realize that they are paying these people based on transactions or based on the fund fees. The other thing to ask is, because the rule change from the Department of Labor around this concept of fiduciary, putting your client's best interest first, that's actually off the table right now. It would not hurt you to go ask an advisor, a broker, a salesperson, are you held to the fiduciary standard? Are you selling me stuff, or is it the case that you are putting me first? And I also think that for many people, they want advisors to do something that they themselves could do. And, you know, I sort of think about this as sort of five big things in a financial life that you really can do yourself and you don't need to go to an advisor. You should be paying down your credit card and auto loan debt and student loan debt. You should absolutely have 6 to 12 months of living expenses in a safe place. That's called your emergency reserve fund. You should be maxing out your retirement plan. $18,500 is the limit in 2018. And then I would put two other items on your to-do list.
Okay.
One is to make sure that you actually are properly insured. And that could be everything from, do you have a renter's insurance policy? Did we have enough storms this year to prove to you that actually having some kind of insurance can be very important? Do you need life insurance? And the last one, I am begging you, I am on bent knee right now, Jeremy Hobson, asking you and everyone else to please prepare your estate documents, meaning putting down on paper what you want to happen if something bad were to occur in your life. Still, not enough people are doing this.
All right. I am going to leave you now with my piece of financial advice. And I give this to a lot of people that I meet, and I can't believe that they need this advice, but they do, which is, do not carry a balance on your credit card.
Do
ever,
not
right?
ever.
You agree
never.
With me on that.
Yes, because I agree with everything you say, Jeremy. I think you know that by now. We've known each other long enough. Don't do that. I'll go one step further. And that is, when you're contemplating any financial decision, don't only look at your upside potential. Don't look at the most optimistic side. Look at both the upside and the downside, and then ask yourself which one of those possibilities is more realistic and which one is going to impact me more. Because if you're taking a swing, you know, on Bitcoin, and you put all, you say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to cash out my IRA. I'm going to take a distribution. I'm going to pay the fee. I'm going to do that. I'm going to put it all on Bitcoin, and you lose it all, then you are a dope, and you've just done something really dumb to yourself.
And you also could end up like the Winklevoss twins. You just never know with Bitcoin.
Yes, and they had a little head start on the rest of us, so that was true.
Good for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Great to talk to you, and I look forward to speaking with you in the new year, Jim.
You too. Happy New Year. Automation can be a politically dirty word in the U.S. It often means that some human has lost his or her job to a machine. But in China, automation is a politician's mantra. Backed by hundreds of billions of dollars in government support, China is installing more robots than any other country on the planet. Asma Khalid of member station WBUR has the story from China.
To see what China's automation revolution looks like, I met up with Jerry Wong at his factory in Shanghai. Wong got his bachelor's, his master's, and his PhD from MIT. But in 2000, he decided to come home to start a telecom equipment company called Cambridge Industries Group.
China is facing a lot of pressures, labor costs, energy costs. And then that's why we put an emphasis on the automation rather than pure rely on low-cost labor.
Wong says back in the 80s and 90s, when China's economy first opened up to the world, labor used to be cheap. But now wages are rising. He pays his factory workers about $1,000 a month.
It's getting difficult competing with lower-cost factories in like Southeast Asia. So this is a big pressure on all the factories in Shanghai, right? So they have to move to the high end of the manufacturing or they're going to have to automate.
And so Wong is on a mission to automate. He says he's already cut his workforce by half. He eventually wants a factory where essentially the humans are just the technicians. And so a couple of years ago, Wong took some of the leaders from his R&D team and gave them a new job, figure out how to automate the factory lines.
He's our chief automation officer.
Hello. Very nice to meet you.
We put on slippers and a robe and step through a door to get decontaminated before we enter the clean room factory. Wong's colleague, Rose Hu, says when the company first started making routers and telecom equipment, everything was done by hand.
We used to have two rows of people sitting there in search. Last year we started to do this.
She points out another assembly line, one that used to take over 60 workers, that now requires about a dozen. As I'm taking photos around the factory floor, I nearly stumble over a little warehouse robot delivering supplies.
Oh, he stopped for me. So he can sense when there's a human. And then he starts again.
Wong's obsession with robots isn't really that unique in his homeland. Last year, Chinese companies bought 87,000 robots. Now, that number might not seem like a lot, but it's about a third of all the robots sold around the globe. Part of China's appetite is directly tied to the government's agenda. China offers incentives to companies to automate. Wong says government subsidies will cover about 20% of his automation costs. But more than the money, it's the political push.
You know, our company is not a big company. But surprisingly, we got a big support. The deputy mayor visited here and gave a really strong encouragement for using more automation technologies.
And all around China, you'll hear stories similar to Wong. Companies craving automation and a government hungry to help. At the World Robot Conference in Beijing, you get a taste of this ecosystem. The convention is this huge shindig with academics, robot companies, and just curious Chinese citizens. And one of the most popular exhibits is a dancing robot troupe. Oh. Little white humanoid robots with blue eyes swivel their arms and bend their knees better than a coordinated dance team. These robots are made by UbiTech. The general manager, Jeff Lee, says the startup has gotten money from private investors, but it also has one key stakeholder.
The government will also have some investment. The city government has big support to us.
Off a dusty alley, we go up a couple flights of stairs to the UbiTech factory. Ye Junwei is the production manager for all the robot joints on the assembly line. Think elbows and knees. He says this factory has two automation lines, one for assembly, the other for testing. He tells us with pride, the goal is to have robots making robots. Junwei says human labor is getting more expensive. Plus, it's not as consistent as a machine. His colleague, Qianqian Guo, chimes in. She says back in March of last year, this facility had 400 factory workers. Now it's down to about 150. Guo says her company recently started construction on a new factory in Yunnan, near the Myanmar border, because of a government grant. She says the Chinese government gave UbiTech the land, the factory, and even the office furniture all for free. For Here and Now, I'm Asma Khalid.
And Asma's story was made possible by the Bringing Home the World International Reporting Fellowship Program for Minority Journalists at the International Center for Journalists. Tomorrow, we'll hear how some U.S. robotics companies are stepping up to fill China's labor shortage. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Merry Christmas from all of us at Here and Now.